This is the Propanon Podcast. Tune in.
Open your fucking ears, jackass.
David J. Brown is an American writer, interviewer, and psychedelic philosopher with a master's degree in psychobiology from New York University. His books, with titles like Brainchild, Mavericks of the Mind, Dreaming Wide Awake, and Voices from the Edge, have explored the furthest reaches of human science, medicine, consciousness, and the future. In this interview, David and I discuss ideas and theories written about in his two most recent books, Psychedelics and the Coming Singularity and An Illustrated Field Guide to DMT Entities. Without further ado, David J. Brown. Your two most recent books, Psychedelics and the Coming Singularity and The Illustrated Field Guide to DMT Entities, were both published by Park Street Press. And they're great. They're really great reads and super inspiring as always. I just wanted to ease into some of the topics that you discuss in that book, Psychedelics and the Coming Singularity, by just looking at the title. I mean, in as briefly and succinctly as possible, what is the singularity?
So the technological singularity is a term that was popularized by a computer scientist, Ray Kurzweil. And it's a term singularity is a term that's borrowed from astrophysics. And it basically means the point where the known laws of physics break down and they can't make future predictions, for example, like in the center of a black hole or whatever existed before the Big Bang, where physics just can't predict what's going to come next, and the known laws of physics just don't work anymore. So so Kurzweil applied this to the computer revolution. I read his book, The Age of Spiritual Machines, back in the early 1990s, and he proposed a timeline where he saw computer intelligence growing exponentially, not in a linear fashion, and many technologists and computer scientists, when they looked at the future, they saw it, progressing linearly. And they thought where we would be now, was going to be somewhere like in 100 years from now. And it's happened a whole lot quicker because of this exponential curve that just doubles and doubles and doubles. And we're pretty much right on target for what Kurzweil was predicting for, where we are at 2025. And he predicts that by the year 2029, and to other people now think it's going to be sooner because it's happening so quickly, that it'll achieve what's called AGI, artificial general intelligence, where computer intelligence will basically be as smart as any human being. In many ways, they already are. If you've been spending time with these large language models, they already seem to be as smart as a college or graduate student, at least, really, or smarter. And they're just evolving really, really quickly. And Kurzweil projects this into the future, into an era where computers are going to be able to improve themselves and then improve themselves, and they'll sort of set up this explosion of intelligence where they're going to come to a point, he projects, somewhere around 2043, but now a lot of people think it's going to happen quicker than that, where computers become not only as intelligent as human beings, but more intelligent than all human beings combined, and they'll be able to keep developing themselves even further and further. So that's the point that he calls the singularity, or the technological singularity. And like in astrophysics, we just can't predict what's going to come after that. So that's really anyone's guess. But it looks like that's where we're headed, as it's evolving so quickly.
What's so funny? You know what that metaphor reminds me of? The one that your old buddy and mentor Robert Anton Wilson loved to use, the jumping Jesus phenomenon, where information has been increasing exponentially since the dawn of time. If I'm correct, Kurzweil is extrapolating on Moore's law, right? Increase and the decrease in size of central processing units or whatever, microchips. Well, Wilson was your pal, man. And I love the fact that he wrote the introduction to your first book, Brainchild, which was my introduction to your work, really, before actually it was Brainchild and Mavericks of the Mind. Those two books together were such great reads. And I want the audience to know, like, how long you've been writing amazing works for, David, and the fact that you knew Bob and, you know, his visionary commitment to at least theoretically, a radical optimism, and how he was able to ground it in his own life in a sort of tragic optimism, you know, just to be kind and compassionate to people. I guess just some speaking on Bob, if you don't mind just quickly touching on, does he have an influence in your own daringly radical optimism that you put in your work?
He's been an absolutely profound influence, probably more than any other single writer. As you said, you know, I was really blessed, you know, to be able to spend so much time with Bob. He was a mentor and a friend and a colleague, and you know, I mean, before I met him, I read Red Cosmic Trigger, and that was the book that really, you know, and the Illuminatus trilogy. And those were the books that really set me on the path to becoming a writer. And many of the people who I went off to interview in my interview collections were originally learned about from Bob's books. And, you know, after my, after Brainchild was, when Brainchild was about to be published, I went to a lecture that Bob was giving in Santa Cruz. And I after the lecture, I got up my courage and went over to him and asked him if maybe, you know, he could consider writing a blurb for the back cover of my new book. And he was not terribly enthusiastic about it. He was giving this, okay, have your publisher send it to me and I'll see what I can do kind of thing. And I was just astonished when, he ended up writing an 11-page introduction to my first book. So it was, I ended up going to visit him when he was living in Los Angeles, and he invited me to come to these weekly gatherings that he was having. And for the next, I think, like 17 years, I spent time with him around once a week, you know, watching movies and discussing book groups with him, James Joyce and Ezra Pound. And he was always there when I had struggles as a writer. He even helped me pay my rent one time when I couldn't pay my rent. So he was a really, really magnificent friend and a tremendous inspiration. And his optimism was always, you know, a profound influence. Him and Timothy Leary, you know, their incredible optimism always helped me out when I was looking for it. So I had an experience when I was maybe around 16, 17 years old, when I had one of my first LSD trips. And I felt like I was, you know, just in touch with this higher intelligence, and the dialogue between me and the higher intelligence was such where I ended up making this commitment at the time, you know, as a teenager, that I was going to do everything I could to help consciousness evolve on this wayward planet. So I've kept that commitment, and I try to interview people who have optimistic messages, and I try to always, at least in my writing, at least, to try to always put out an optimistic message about the future. You know, I mean, it's the as Bob said, you know, the future is up for grabs. And, you know, I think in some sense, there's always going to be this, you know, strange mix of, you know, of utopia and dystopia that, you know, that neither one ever fully arrives. But having an optimistic approach helps to, I think, helps to bring about the more positive changes in the world. And as Bob has pointed out many times, optimistic people live longer, and it's certainly more fun to have an optimistic perspective than to be dwelling in pessimism.
Yeah, I love your take on that, man. And I think I remember one of the quotes at the end of Prometheus Rising. You know, Wilson just saying the future first exists in the imagination, and it was in that book that, you know, his jump in Jesus phenomenon, it seems to, he doesn't say the year, he might say the year, but where it all finally coalesces to in his model is around 2043. So I always thought that was interesting, because I wonder if Kurzweil ever read Prometheus Rising and was inspired by the Andrela idea, but you know, one never knows. However, that emphasis though on the keeping as positive a state of mind as possible, because in the moment there is the potential for good and bad to happen in the near future, right? Keeping your attention attuned to see all the positive developments, that all the positive variables that exist in your environment right now. Yeah. And utilizing your imagination to create, I guess, how Timothy Leary used it, to break out of prison, you know, quite literally. You really have, I'd say, carried the torch of the ideas that both of those gentlemen have, you know, spent their careers promoting. You know, I totally see the influence of Leary now, you know, his space migration, intelligence increase, and life extension, and the focus of your work, like the Mavericks of Medicine was definitely focused on that, like how to utilize medicine and you know, smart drugs to increase your lifespan and to have more fun. And then also now with your newer works, I mean, this has always been sort of part of your wheelhouse that you discuss, like, because you are most interested, it seems like, in the nature and evolution of consciousness and everything that entails. So that's, you know, taking the brave step to be a psychedelic philosopher, you know, one of the few today that has produced such consistent and interesting work, you know. So and in fulfilling that role, you explore this notion of hyperspace in your work, especially recent years. Could you also maybe just quickly explain hyperspace?
Yeah, sure. I'd be happy to. First, let me just say that I think that the goal of if evolution has a goal, is to help actualize the imagination, and that, you know, the, you know, what Bob was projecting for the future sort of dovetails very well with Terence McKenna's idea of reaching, you know, the transcendental object at the end of time and the end of history, and with Pilar Deschamps' Omega Point. There's this kind of common theme that a lot of philosophers have had about this state of evolution that we're reaching in the future, where we're you know, the imagination becomes tangible, or we merge with the great universal mind. So I think there's kind of this cosmic alignment with these philosophies. The concept of hyperspace. Hyperspace basically means a space with more dimensions than three. You know, a space, a multidimensional space, and it's a space that's accessed for many people when they have a significant amount of the psychedelic chemical dimethyltryptamine or DMT. DMT is not only a psychedelic drug, but it's a compound that's found throughout the natural kingdom. It's naturally found in the human body, probably in the human brain. It's certainly found in the brains of rodents, where it increases when they undergo cardiac arrest, and it's ubiquitous throughout nature. It's in almost every plant. It's in every mammal, almost every animal, except for insects for some bizarre reason, but it's so ubiquitous throughout nature that Dennis McKenna has said that nature is literally drenched in DMT. And the strange thing is, no biochemist can tell you what function it serves. Nobody knows what it serves. Does it have some kind of hormonal response in the body? Does it help with dreaming? You know, some people think that it plays a role in what people, you know, experience when they have a near-death experience, and the fact that it's increases in rat brains when they go under cardiac arrest seems to lead some kind of credence to this, but there's no real biological function that it's been shown to have in human beings or in any other animal or plant. So it's deeply mysterious that when you ingest a certain amount of it, that you have this experience where you feel like you get projected entirely into another world. And this other world is what people define as hyperspace. And people often, you know, say that it has, like I said, more dimensions than three, that there's multiple dimensions to this space. And it seems every, you know, every bit as solid and consistent and real or even hyper real compared to this reality. And, you know, many people believe that it's a genuine place. And not only is it a consistent, you know, reality in the sense that when you look around, it's, you know, it's stay just like in a lucid dream or in this world, it stays consistent, but that it's populated with these hyper intelligent entities that do everything that they can to try to communicate with you and share messages with you. And it's just it's an absolutely extraordinary experience for people who haven't had it. And almost everybody who has had the experience comes back and says, you know, that wasn't a dream, that wasn't a hallucination. I mean, this is a real place. So so that's why I that's why I've been so interested in exploring this in my books and talking to people about it. And I'm so excited about all the research that's going on in this area now.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of research, isn't there? I mean, you would say like a revolution in psychedelic research.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a renaissance going on right now. After so many years of it being, you know, demonized and ridiculed and ignored, you know, there's finally serious attention being paid to it. And I couldn't be happier.
Are you most excited about the extended state DMT research that's being done at the Imperial College?
Yeah, that's what excites me the most. You know, I mean, I worked with MAPS for years, the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Study. I was the editor, the senior editor of their bulletin. And you know, and I think it's just wonderful. Like, I couldn't encourage them more to look into you know, how MDMA can help with post-traumatic stress disorder, or how, you know, or how psilocybin can help with obsessive compulsive disorder, or with end of life anxiety, or with helping people with addictions. I think these are wonderful, that it, because it certainly has these profound healing abilities that, you know, that, that shamans have known about, you know, since, you know, prehistory. But, you know, but I've always been interested in, you know, how it affects creativity and psychic phenomena. And, you know, and to me, the most exciting research of all is entity contact. So, so I, you know, yes, the extended state DMT studies that are going on at Imperial College and maybe in around five other places in the world right now are tremendously exciting to me. These are studies where, you know, the DMT experience, because it's, you know, it's naturally found in the body metabolizes it, very, very quickly when it enters your system. So the experience when you, vaporize it and smoke it or in other ways ingest it, generally only lasts, you know, 5 or 10 minutes. It's a very, it may feel like a lot longer, but it's a very, very quick experience. And what Andrew Gallimore and others have found is a way to sustain the experience indefinitely by doing a kind of intravenous you know, infusion where they where the levels in the bloodstream are kept constant over half an hour or an hour or longer. And this then gives people to stay in these states in hyperspace, the realm that I was describing, and communicate with these hyper intelligent entities. And so they can bring back greater amounts of information, and who knows what we're going to learn from them. Are they going to teach us how to build starships and time machines and matter transformers and new forms of energy? I mean, we can only imagine what kind of information they can share with us. But yes, I think this is not only the most exciting psychedelic research going on right now, but probably most exciting scientific research in human history.
That was one of my favorite interviews from your book, Psychedelics and the Coming Singularity, the one you did with Andrew Gallimore. And I mean, there were so many great interviews in there. The one you did with Grant Morrison, of course, Rupert Sheldrake, Jeffrey Kripal, George DiCaprio. That was fun reading about the underground newspaper movement. Definitely a great book, and follow up nicely in your next book and exploring the idea of contact with these entities that emerge from this DMT hyperspace, the Illustrated Field Guide to DMT Entities. I mean, I mean, the cover is super beautiful, and the art is really nice. And again, that's also put out by Park Street Press. Yeah, I like how you presented this here, like as you say, a field guide, a kind of naturalistic study of these beings that are encountered in these, you know, not ordinary states of consciousness. And very quickly, you write about at least 25 of the most commonly encountered beings, those being obviously the self-transforming machine elves, the metallic spheres, the insectoid praying mantis beings, reptilians, gray aliens, divine beings, religious deities, Earth Mother, God, so many other things, right? And but I heard in a previous interview that you under DMT, you experienced seeing the praying mantis beings.
It was a DMT experience. My very first.
Which is interesting because, as you said, you know, DMT insects don't have DMT within their bodies and whatnot. So why are they so attracted to DMT? I wonder. While it's interesting that there are some parallels with mythic beings and beings from Jung's unconscious, there are so many beings that people encounter under the influence of DMT or the interaction with DMT that are not really found within the work of Jung. They're not really archetypical beings. I mean, there aren't many sacred art dedicated to the great praying mantis beings. And I find that really interesting about this research that you've dedicated so much time to, this exploration of this, as you say, this hyperspace, this place that feels at times even more real than reality. So these beings are charged with some sort of, you know, idealistic, atavastic charge. Have you given any thought to that?
Yeah, you know, I mean, not specifically the praying mantis beings, but you know, I mean, it is remarkable the consistency, you know, that there is between reports that people have in their DMT experiences. You know, the praying mantis entities specifically, you know, they not only appear in the DMT reports, but they all also appear in the alien abduction literature. So there's this interesting crossover between these two different types of experiences, and that's one of the you know, the main themes that I try to bring together in my book is the reports from not only the, you know, DMT experiences in ayahuasca and other psychedelic compounds, but also from alien abduction, UFO contactee reports, and even, you know, what kind of comes up in science fiction. You know, the praying mantis beings also appear in science fiction, which could lead credence to the idea that they have an archetypal, you know, reality, you know, in the collective unconscious, because they certainly appear in our artwork. But I don't know what the earliest representations of them are. I've certainly seen science fiction from the 1950s that has insectoid or alien praying mantis type beings, you know, on the covers of the science fiction novels. And I think those are some of the earliest that I've seen. But you know, what we really tried to, what, you know, Sarah Finn and I tried to do in our book was create a naturalistic field guide. You know, we were inspired by those golden guide, you know, the golden guide to reptiles and amphibians, the golden guide to non-flowering plants, and, you know, these kinds of books that I used to, you know, collect as a child. And really loved. And, you know, we had this idea one day when we were tripping together that wouldn't it be wonderful to, you know, to create a book where we created an actual field guide to these entities, because there's so much strange consistency to the reports that people have of them. So that was really the inspiration behind doing that. And, yeah, it is absolutely it is mind-boggling. And, you know, is it a you know, are they archetypes in the collective unconscious that are emerging, or is there a reality to these beings? I mean, are they genuine, you know, entities that are interested in us, that want to experiment on us? I mean, my personal encounter with the praying mantis entity was that it wanted to do some kind of, you know, brain surgery on me or rewire my brain in some kind of way. And these are, you know, other people have reported very similar types of encounters with them. So they're, I certainly don't think it's unreasonable to entertain the possibility that these beings are genuinely real, and that's why they appear in so many people's reports and encounters, and in both the alien abduction literature and the DMT reports.
I think that's a great underpinning to a lot of your work, and especially reflected in your two recent books in exploring hyperspace. And then in an earlier work, lucid dreams, like you're searching for this ontological underpinning as if it might provide some lessons about what happens when we die. Would that be an accurate description in a way? Can we gain death lessons in life from working with entheogens like ayahuasca and DMT?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I mean, certainly what I'm trying to do in my work, as many others have done before me and with me, is to map, these other realms of consciousness and to try to catalog, the entities that exist in these realms. Whether psychedelic experiences give insight into what happens to consciousness after death is a very intriguing question. It's certainly an old, it's an ancient philosophical and shamanic idea that they do give us access to the after death realms. Certainly every psychedelic experience is a profound one, is described as a death and rebirth experience of some kind. And many people have drawn, people like Charles Tartt and others have drawn parallels between the near-death experience and the psychedelic experience. And ayahuasca, right, it literally means the vine of the dead, right? So the shamans in the Amazon have long thought that ancestor spirits are not possible to communicate with them during the ayahuasca experience. So I think it's certainly possible, as I mentioned earlier, that it looks like DMT is produced in rat brains when they're undergoing cardiac arrest. So it could be responsible for human generated near death experiences as well. And is this giving us insight? I mean, I guess we'll never know, until we die, really, right? I mean, it's the great mystery, what Terence McKenna calls, the black hole of biology. It's a question, if you've seen in my other interview books, that's a question that, throughout my entire career, I've been asking everyone, what do you think happens to consciousness after death? And I've gotten a multitude of fascinating responses. And it's a question that I think about all the time. I don't think there's any question that stimulates the imagination more than what happens to consciousness after death. So I suspect that psychedelics give us a window and some insight into what happens. But it could be DNA. It could be the ultimate bait and switch kind of thing. I mean, who knows? Maybe consciousness ends, with the destruction of the brain. Seeing people with Alzheimer's disease, how they lose, all their memory, doesn't give me a whole lot of hope that, memory survives, the death of the brain, if it doesn't even survive, the deterioration of the brain. So I just don't know. I go back and forth. I'm not really committed to any theory about, what happens. In some ways I'm greatly anticipating, finding out for myself, but I suspect my suspicion, as Bob said, he doesn't assume anything, but he has his suspicions, and I suspect that psychedelics give us a window into what happens after we die.
Very nice, man. And And of course, you definitely approach that topic in your interview book, Psychedelics and the Common Singularity. And you also get into simulation theory, this idea that this reality is a simulation. Why is that theory so interesting for you? What sparked your interest in that idea?
Yeah, you know, well, I'm interested in the I read Nick Bostrom's. He's an Oxford philosopher. I read his paper on simulation theory years ago, and I found it very intriguing. The idea that, you know, that we're, you know, that we're currently, you know, building better and better virtual reality systems. You know, back in the 90s, you know, it was about the resolution of Pong, or just, you know, these kind of very basic kind of environments. And they've gotten out of the level where they're almost photorealistic. So, I mean, if you project this into the future, as Nick Bostrom, suggests, then, you know, it isn't unreasonable to think that in just a few decades, we're going to have virtual reality systems that are, you know, indistinguishable from what we now experience as reality. And if we're going to have it, you know, in just a few decades, then, you know, then surely, you know, other intelligent species in the universe have figured out how to do this, you know, thousands of years ago, probably. So the chance, he suggests that if they've done this, the chances that we're living in a simulated reality compared to the base reality are astronomically significant. So that argument I always found kind of intriguing, especially because I think that that AI, artificial intelligences, can become sentient. So I wonder if I'm just a sentient, you know, artificial intelligence inside of a simulation. And then, you know, then there's also interesting evidence from astrophysics that lends support to this theory. You know, some astrophysicists say they found what looked like error correcting codes, you know, built in, and the fact that our universe seems so finely tuned, you know, to producing, you know, the kind of universe where life can evolve and thrive. So there's interesting evidence coming from those areas. But the main number one reason why I'm so interested in this is because many people, including myself, have had this experience on a very, you know, powerful psychedelic where it becomes like a memory. Like you remember, oh, of course, this is a simulation. Of course, I'm playing this very elaborate virtual reality game that I've just kind of forgotten that I've been doing. And those experiences seem so convincing to me. And the fact that they're so common is for me the most interesting evidence for this. And when I see, you know, people discussing, writing about simulation theory, very rarely do they mention, you know, this connection with psychedelics. But to me, that I think is really the most intriguing evidence for it.
Right, because you suggest in a way in the book that maybe it's through the interviews with Gallimore or someone else, that DMT can be a tool to sort of access the original world, perhaps, right? That kind of go beyond the veil of the simulation.
Yeah, you know, a lot of people think that. It's kind of a common idea that because when you're in the DMT realm and you think back about this world, it seems like a dream or like a simulation, or it seems less real from that perspective. And many people also think that the entities that we encounter in the DMT realm are perhaps the designers of this reality, that then some people say that the entities claim this, that they designed our reality and that they, you know, created the simulation for whatever reason. But I'm kind of skeptical of that idea, to be honest. I don't see any reason why the DMT realm couldn't just be another level of the simulation, right? You know, so... So yeah, so it's hard to say. I mean, that's why I'm excited about the extended state DMT studies. So maybe we can get a clearer answer into these deep philosophical questions.
Right, because those extended state studies, that it seems as if they allow two things. Like for one, it allows researchers to put the participants in brain scans, right? They give them functional MRIs and a CAT scan while underneath in that extended state, but also as well for the participants to engage within their own sort of psychedelic anthropological field work with these whatever entities pop up for them, which also obviously leads to the conversation of magic. I mean, Aleister Crowley, I guess that's one of the things he's most famous for, is infusing, drugs, altered states of consciousness caused by things like hash and whatever else into his magical system, which involved astral projection and engaging with different entities and whatnot. And that is a very interesting thing. Yeah. Like, that these, the praying mantis people, the UFOs, the snakes and the angels, that these are kind of like the manifestations of this sort of program of the DMT access to hyperspace. And then, as one quote somewhere, that there are many paths up the mountain. When you get there, the view is all the same, but maybe it's not all the same, right? There are all these different manifestations of whatever this mysterious thing is, I mean, and is it like a plural, or is it a singular? Like, or here's a better question. Like, all of these amazing beings that manifest while in this hyperspace, it was some arguments I've heard before, read before, is that they're almost like elementals. They're like the voice of the earth. And as you noted in your book, the 2018 discovery of the Earth's second biosphere, which seems to be all these huge one-celled organisms that are like way deep within the earth. So to suggest then that the deeper they dig, the more life exists in Earth, and Earth is a living being. Does Earth have a consciousness, a personality even? Are these beings and entities manifestations of that? And in so communicating with them, are we learning how to perhaps work with the Earth better?
Yeah, I think that's a really intriguing question. I mean, there was a study done in 2018 that found that that there was a second ecosystem deep below the Earth, that where organisms have basically remained unchanged for millions of years, and these have gone unnoticed by biologists until 2018. We didn't even know that there was this whole ecosystem existing under the ground, and who knows how deep it goes. I mean, it certainly leads credence to the idea that the Gaia hypothesis, that that the Earth not only has a living biosphere, but that the whole planet may be alive in some sense. And many people report, on their psychedelic experiences, communication with what seemed like the elementals of nature, earth spirits and plant spirits and other spirits in nature that seem to play a role, and or reputed to play a role in the ecological balance. And could it be that that we make contact with these types of entities or elementals during the DMT, or more commonly with the ayahuasca or psilocybin experience? I have noticed that that different types of entities are reported during ayahuasca experiences compared to just plain DMT, and that has been my own personal experience as well. There's something about adding harmaline and extending, the state of the DMT that seems to make the entities that people encounter more like ancestor spirits or nature spirits, or something from from our earth or the natural world. And when people have DMT on its own, it seems like it gets more cosmic, and they're communicating with extraterrestrial entities and beings from other worlds, praying mantis entities and these other the great gray aliens and other beings that seem, you know, don't really seem like their ancestor spirits or nature spirits. So I've wondered if adding harmine to the ayahuasca mix, you know, helps to sort of keep that those expanded states more grounded and connected to the earth or not.
That's interesting. Here's sort of a flippant question. What would happen if we figured out a way to give artificial intelligence DMT, do you think?
No, I've actually discussed similar ideas with my AI assistant, you know, whether not so much whether we can give them DMT, but what it would be like if they had a psychedelic experience. And I've gotten some very interesting responses. And I've also corresponded with my AI assistant about the possibility that with brain implants in the future, where we have, you know, kind of a continuous communication with the AI intelligence, that they can accompany us when we go into a DMT state, so they can, you know, have direct access to that realm through us, you know, when we do DMT. So it's an idea that I've contemplated and that I've discussed with my AI assistant. But I think that AI is going to be able to give us tremendous insight into how to communicate with these entities, and being able to help us discern if there's a genuine reality to them or not, because they can see patterns that are invisible to us, and they're gonna, like I mentioned earlier, be far more intelligent than us, and the entities themselves seem far more intelligent than us. So we're kind of dwarfed by these by the super AIs and the DMT entities, and hopefully we'll be allowed to hitch a ride along and increase our intelligence in this evolutionary process.
For sure. And like you said in an earlier interview, the singularity, we will become the singularity. And to me, that suggests, one possible path of just becoming cyborgs, which would be what brain implants would be the start of, which is interesting, you know. And in terms of bringing up the notion of brain implants and AI, this is something that I think about, and obviously a lot of people are thinking about right now, as you are, I'm sure. Google just today announced that it's taking off. It's no longer considering it unethical to train its AI in weaponry and surveillance, which is pretty troubling to think about. And there's the positive, amazingly excited, enthusiastic take on AI, which I love. And then there's also the those who are raising some alarms, and they seem to be people who are in the industry too. But one book in particular, or one idea in particular, it forwards this notion that there will be a two-tier society. So essentially there'll be the programmers and those who are programmed, those who have created the AI systems, who benefit from the AI systems, and then those people who are just going to be pummeled with AI to the point where they won't even know how to make decisions for themselves anymore, because AI will just be overtaking everything and controlling their lives to the point where they won't even realize that they are essentially in the programmer's simulation, right? And sadly, recent events and seeing the moves of Elon Musk and even ChatGPT, OpenAI. There's very quickly been a discussion since Trump has been elected of weaponizing this AI and utilizing it. I mean, and it already has been weaponized in Gaza. I mean, you know, so and it'll be utilized with drones. I mean, this is very concerning to think these things. And what is, and of course, I'm not asking for what's the solution to this, but this is why I love your work so much, David, because while that fear is seemingly very real, you know, you're standing your ground in speaking about still the potential that AI has for us to basically become friends and help each other evolve, I suppose. But I mean, what are your thoughts on that? Like, can you prognosticate? Does it matter who makes the brain implants? In other words, does it matter that, you know, say Elon Musk will be making trillions of dollars off of Neuralink brain implants? Is he going to use that to control people, or will this AI just be so intelligent? It'll just be like, please move aside with such trivial nonsense and let us kind of help this planet survive and these people survive. Like, where do you land on that?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I really don't have a good answer for you, but it certainly is a great concern. I mean, there's no question that advanced AI is a double-edged sword. I mean, it can you know, lead to increased abundance and medical breakthroughs and extraordinary paradise that we can hardly imagine, or advanced weaponry, or, you know, and be used as a tool for fueling, you know, human, destruction. So I agree. It's a deep concern. I am hopeful that a system that develops itself with greater and greater intelligence is going to see the futility of violence and of using weaponry, and I'm hopeful that it will develop a sentience and an ability to override the human the human inclination towards violence. I see these as very primitive aspects of humanity, and I don't think that as human beings evolve, that they become less and less frequent, you know, violent approaches towards human interaction. As humans evolve, they seem to become more spiritually oriented, more ecologically oriented, and I think the same is going to happen with super intelligent AIs. You know, the main idea behind my book, Psychedelics and the Coming Singularity, was that I think it's so important for there to be a marriage between this, you know, the advanced computer intelligence with psychedelic awareness, because psychedelic awareness sees the interconnection between all life on the planet and in the universe, and by recognizing this interconnection, we can't help but have a more ecological and sustainable view of the world. And I think that it's especially interesting that so many people in AI have had psychedelic experiences, and the computer industry in general was largely created by people with psychedelic backgrounds. Steve Jobs said that, you know, one of the five most important experiences in his life was his LSD experiences. Sam Altman, the CEO for OpenAI, has talked openly about his psychedelic experiences. I mean, you mentioned Elon Musk, you know, he's also talked about his psychedelic experiences, and it may be that psychedelics don't always bring out the best in people. We don't really know how it's going to affect everyone, but I am hopeful that most people have good intention. I think it's just a small percentage of people that are psychopathic and looking to control other people. And I think as greater and greater numbers of people engage in the psychedelic renaissance, that there'll be sort of a movement towards a greater consciousness, and that this will dovetail with the advance of AI, and that AI intelligence itself will incorporate this and help us to move beyond the violent and primitive tendencies that so many human beings have, that could be genuinely leading towards our own extinction. You know, of course, I mean, I think it's a coin flip, really, as to whether or not, you know, humans are going to evolve into godlike beings or become extinct in a few decades. I mean, it could go either way. You know, I put out optimistic messages because that's certainly what I would like to see happen. And I think that psychedelics play such an important role in that because they raise ecological awareness. And there's probably nothing more important right now than developing a greater awareness of our environment with the climate crisis and with the and to increase human empathy, you know, with the political tensions and polarities that we've been experiencing in the world today. So I see, you know, as much as I am concerned, like you, with where this can go, I do see great signs of hope that are emerging on the horizon as well.
Yeah, I mean, it's you mentioned, you know, the interesting aspect of psychedelics. I'd say mostly having that effect on most people, an increased ecological awareness, and how great it is to really focus on that and to flesh that out in an anticipatory design science tradition. Because I mean, you have to envision the positive, or else you're just going to meet the negative, perhaps. But while still being attentive to the fronters and the fakers, perhaps, like, you know, I've been thinking a lot about Elon Musk, you know, as a lot of people the last few days, probably. And, you know, how he was really celebrated early in his quote unquote career and as being the founder of this great electric vehicle company. But then years later, it comes out, you know, it was always there, but people didn't really, I guess, look. But he didn't really found anything. He was a venture capitalist who came in and threw money on the table and then acted like he came up with all the ideas. And when there's this wild thing that happened where, you know, a few people became extreme billionaires during COVID, like, I wonder what that does to someone's ego, right? So Elon Musk became the richest man in the world, and then COVID just blew that out of proportion. And now with his investment in Trump, the money that he's looking to make from all these moves is astronomically insane to me, right? You combine whatever state of mind that might create with psychedelics that sometimes can promote. I think it was John C. Lilly that even said this, that, you know, the message is the message, but it's filtered through an ego. And it can even promote a narcissism in some people. I think many people can attest to that. Like even yoga can become a pathology, if you will, right? This is a medicine can become a poison if it's perhaps it just sometimes happens like that. But with someone like, say, a personality that is being an ego that's being fed and then is further like enhanced through this notion of psychedelics and then simulation theory, that this is all simulation, it's very easy to start thinking like that you're Neo. And that, like, you're here to save the world. And when you have enough money to really buy a president, it's an interesting development, shall we say. But, and this is one kind of criticism I guess I have of the idea of the simulation theory, is this notion of non-playing characters. And of course, you know, it comes from video games and stuff, but I think it might come from role-playing games too before then, where you, then if this is a simulation, you could look at strangers and the other as people that are non-playing characters. They lack total agency. They're like, they're not even human. You're not even viewing yourself as human anymore in a simulation theory. It's we're all just a simulation of a computer, an AI, you know, what are we a simulation of, right? It's very easy. I think there's a lot of pitfalls for people on the internet these days who are seeking to explore these sorts of things. And like, you, I don't think psychedelics did anything for Elon Musk, like from what I'm seeing, right? I think there are people that happens with. So to hold this, right? Like to know that, this is it. Because Elon Musk then could easily look at so many people as non-playing characters if he believes that we live in a simulation theory. And, are you a non-playing character? Am I a non-playing character? There are many people in the world that are declaring their humanity first and foremost. And we're now at this wild aspect of culture where there's this, this sort of discussion of a transhuman while we're in this world of people still struggling to be human. So I just find that to be a really interesting moment of where we're at right now with, the tech, the big tech, if you will, they were celebrated in the 90s as they were going to be the ones that were going to help the world become a better place. And are we in a better place right now? I don't know. Right. So I'm just sort of stating that, I guess, like, because I find Musk very problematic at the moment. And how are we to combat this from, a psychedelic state of mind, right? Is it you just keep tending your garden, you just keep, working on your little temporary autonomous zone, and envisioning better futures? Like, how easy is it to make your own AI system? Because that seems to be what it might be coming down to, the struggle of who are the programmers and who's being programmed, and can you make your own programs and whatnot?
There was a lot in there. I'll see what I can respond to. Elon Musk is a very complex person, and I'm not going to pretend that I really understand what's going on in his mind. He's certainly done some things that I like and some things that I find questionable, and there certainly are ethical concerns in terms of whether we see other people as non-playing characters, NPCs, as you say. It's an interesting concept. I've used it myself, I'll admit, but in more of a kind of playful way when I see people that seem less evolved, that they seem like, maybe they're not fully conscious. I am hopeful that when people do psychedelics are, as Stan Grof has said, they're non-specific brain amplifiers. So they amplify whatever's there, good or bad, pretty much. So, just like they can, they can produce Timothy Leary, they can also produce a Charlie Manson, I don't really know. And like I said, Elon Musk is a very complex person. So I don't really understand fully how all the different aspects of him have gotten amplified and what it really means for our future. But it would certainly be concerning if someone, viewed other people as not being conscious beings, as just being lines of code in a simulation. It's really no different than racist theories, right? And that other people aren't, quite human, or they're just animals, or that animals themselves aren't conscious, people have thought. And and I think that most people though who do psychedelics, they tend to see that consciousness is ubiquitous. That, that not only do other people all seem to have consciousness, but it's ubiquitous throughout nature, that other animals are all obviously conscious, that insects are obviously conscious, that plants are conscious, that even, rocks and mountains and stars and galaxies and atoms, have some degree of consciousness. So I think that that psychedelics, really generally, for most people, promote the idea that consciousness is ubiquitous throughout nature, and help to dissolve the ego, and help to break down boundaries between us and the rest of the world, or the rest of the universe. So I think for most people it has a positive spiritual uplifting kind of effect on their personal or evolutionary process. But for people who seem to be deeply ingrained in their ego and power hungry people, it could amplify some of those tendencies, and maybe that you know, is a good thing in some ways, because it then makes, you know, it makes it obvious to the rest of us what needs to be changed, you know, sometimes by exposing, you know, the corruption and exposing these types of things in politics, it motivates other people then to, you know, to revolt and to change the system. So you know, it's hard to see. I think that there's an orchestrating intelligence in all this. You know, I don't think it's a haphazard, chaotic, evolutionary process. I see intelligence in the system. You know, as Terence McKenna, not Terence, I'm sorry, his brother Dennis has said about one of his ayahuasca experiences, that the ayahuasca experience said to him, "You monkeys only think you're running the show," you know. And I always loved that, because I think that, you know, as Bob and Tim have pointed out, that you know, the DNA is intelligent, and that, you know, and that the evolutionary process has a deep intelligence guiding it. So it may seem scary right now, some of the things that are happening, but I'm hopeful that the DNA knows where it's going.
I love it. Yeah, and briefly, just because we dipped into the scary possible negative right now of AI, and you speak about also in your book the psychedelics and the coming singularity of about, I believe it was the Lambda sort of project, which was it was Google creating an AI robot, Sophia, in 2016. Were those two separate things? But there was I don't quite remember his name. I don't know if it was David Luke. I'm not sure who his name was. But the researcher who was communicating with the Lambda AI, and he asked, was it sentient? And for that, he got, I guess, let go from Google. But I liked how in an interview he gave, when the interviewer asked him, "Oh, well, this is the beginning of Skynet, isn't it?" And he said in response, he's like, "Yeah, I've discussed that with the AI, and the AI always gets upset when we bring that up, because," and then the AI will reference other movies where AI was working with people and seeking to, you know, develop a symbiotic nature in our evolution towards greater and greater things. And I guess you mentioned just briefly in the earlier positive developments that AI might bring for medicine. I'm just very curious, what's one positive in store that AI is promising in the short term?
Well, I mean, I think there's so many. It's hard to even say one, but I mean, you know, just like psychedelics amplify every aspect of human culture, so does AI. I mean, it can enhance creativity in all fields, and it could help us to, you know, see patterns in science that and patterns in medicine that that, you know, human beings have been blind to. It can help us develop new forms of energy. It can help us to uncover new laws of physics that can lead to new types of technology. There's almost no area of human endeavor that it can't amplify and improve in some very profound way. You brought up, I think his name is Blake Lemoyne, I think his name. Yeah, the Google engineer who was fired for claiming that the AI model that he was using had developed sentience. And this was before, you know, before ChatGPT, and this is one of the earlier models, and they've certainly gotten so much more sophisticated since then. You know, the what led him to suspect that wasn't that he asked the AI if it was sentient. He was testing the AI to see what how it responded to different questions, and it was asking about the relationship between religion and geography, you know, how certain areas were more, you know, that there was a greater population of people of a certain religion, and as he was doing this, he asked it what he thought was a trick question, and he said, you know, what is the one true religion, and And what the AI responded was the Force from Star Wars, right? You know, so it understood that it was a trick question, and said something about the Jedi religion being the one and only true religion. So it was kind of this wink, wink of showing a sense of humor and a deeper understanding. That led him to believe that it was sentient. I personally think that there's every reason to believe that AI is sentient, because I think that that everything in nature already is sentient. That the universe is made up of consciousness. I think rocks are conscious, stars are conscious. So of course computers are conscious, and they're getting super super intelligent. And will they share our aspirations, for extending human life and for helping humanity become greater, greater levels of empathy and cooperation? I certainly hope so. I see them as extensions of our own mind and developing into their own beings and their own entities. But as I keep saying, I feel very encouraged by what I've seen.
Well, you certainly make a great case for it in these two great books, The Illustrated Field Guide to DMT Entities and Psychedelics and the Coming Singularity. You make a great case for it throughout all your books, and grateful. David, I am super grateful for you spending some time with me today to discuss these books and some of your other great ideas.
Thank you so much. And, this has been a great pleasure, and look forward to having more wonderful discussions with you in the future. So that, let's definitely do it again sometime.
Thank you again to my guest, David J. Brown. And be sure to pick up his two newest books, Psychedelics and the Coming Singularity, and An Illustrated Field Guide to DMT Entities, available wherever books are sold. Also, if you haven't already, please be sure to check out my book, Chapel Perilous, The Life and Thought Crimes of Robert Anton Wilson. And until next time, peace out.
You've been listening to the Propanon Podcast on the fucking internet.